Hello, my name's Jordan Marr. I'm a farmer in the North Okanagan, and this is Farming in British Columbia, a podcast that appreciates the value of good search engine optimization. Today's episode features my conversation with Mike Harris, apple grower and co-owner of Dominion Cider Company based in Summerland. You'll learn how Mike went from an oil and gas job and no farming experience to managing an apple orchard and producing great cider in just a few years. Why the snobs who say you can't make good cider with dessert apples are totally right and totally wrong. And how one of the best recent investments Mike made in the business made him less efficient at what he does. A note that I interviewed Mike in early December, well before the cold snap that did so much damage to grapevines in the southern interior. So later on, when he breezes through the challenges facing fruit growers in the region, he's not being insensitive. He's just not being clairvoyant. Okay, so Mike Harris was born and raised in Summerland in the 80s and 90s, which meant he could be anywhere in town and randomly toss a stone over his shoulder, and there's a good chance it would land in an orchard. But other than doing some fruit picking and other casual work for farmers for some cash during high school, he had little connection to agriculture, and he left high school with zero interest in pursuing farming as a career.
Most of the kids of farmers that I went to high school with often would complain about having to get up early and help their dad with, you know, some, you know, project, whether it was spraying or thinning or picking. And so in general, the kind of overall impression was it was like a lot of work, not a lot of pay. And that actually is pretty accurate. So in fact, that early impression was quite close to reality.
So after high school in Summerland, Mike left and completed a bachelor degree in business and then some graduate work in environmental science.
No, I think, you know, in high school and, you know, early university, I was like, nope, I want to do work for a big company, do international business, travel around. You know, I was imagining more like living in a high rise apartment and working at in a downtown, you know, office building more than I was imagining putting on, you know, gumboots and dirty jeans every day.
Mike did spend some time traveling and then settled into some work in the oil and gas sector as a health and safety advisor. The work wasn't exactly what he'd pictured, though. His intention had been to work in the renewable energy sector, but his current job did pay well.
And you'd sort of make enough money that could then last you the rest of the year to do other stuff, which would be sort of more fun. And in fact, was instrumental in being able to save up enough money to then later buy a property several years later.
So Mike was spending his winters making good money up north, but found himself with lots of downtime in Vancouver during the summer. And he had a few friends who were goofing around with making their own beer and wine and cider.
And I was really kind of interested in that as well. And that's sort of the germ of the idea of starting the cider company came from, which was sort of related to this desire to do some sort of craft-based business.
But what kind of craft-based business? Mike and his friends were really interested in fermentation, but they ruled out beer and wine because both appeared to require both a large investment to get started and also a substantial combination of knowledge and experience for any new entrant to be able to compete in these very mature and very competitive product categories.
But craft cider, which was like, as I say, I'm trying to remember, you know, 10 years ago, this was like a pretty new category. There was a handful of people making cider, and I had the opportunity to kind of meet some of them, and they were, you know, just like me, no real experience, no 10 years apprenticing in Belgium. You know, it was just like they made a batch in a carboy one year and decided to scale that up and try making it as a business with sort of minimal capital investment. And once I kind of saw that piece, it kind of like really tied into sort of like, oh, my upbringing was actually in Summerland where we grow a lot of apples and I have a lot of contacts there. It wasn't hard to kind of get in touch with people who did the actual work that would be necessary to start a cidery. So came up and did some exploratory meetings, hung out with a few cider makers that were kind of doing a small craft cider thing here in Summerland, and kind of realized rather quickly that like there's nothing so complicated about what these guys are doing, at least on the cider component. You know, that's certainly on the orcharding, there was, you know, obviously a lot there that I didn't know, but at least, you know, from the outset, from the outside, looking at how they make cider, I was like, well, actually, this looks like something we could reasonably expect to achieve with sort of limited startup capital, which is all we had.
What I think I'm hearing as subtext, partly, it must have been a little exciting that cider was emergent, but also potentially maybe in your minds as someone getting into this from scratch, like your perception would it have been that it was just also more forgiving to like figure it out? Because I imagine if you'd started a microbrewery, you know, you're going to be competing right off the jump with like
dozens and dozens of fantastic breweries all over the province.
Yes, exactly. It seemed like there was this opportunity here with craft cider that maybe we were on the early side of kind of realizing that was a category that was both viable, and there were kind of early steps in BC where there's like a handful at the time, there's maybe like four craft cideries that were operating. So it seemed like maybe this is an opportunity to get in on the ground floor, just like you said, you know, and ride this sort of wave of that would be hopefully similar to the craft beer wave. And to some degree, that was the case, you know, and it still is the case. Like there's now, I think, 40 cideries in BC the last time I checked at the craft scale, and that's only in the last 8 years. Now, it's nowhere near the same scale as craft beer and wine. In fact, like as a category, cider still is like 1% of the total alcohol market or something. You know, it's like some very, very niche thing, really. But, you know, even if you're in a niche, if it's a small enough niche, and you're a big enough player, that's still like going to be an exciting kind of viable business that you could do. So like I say, it seemed like there was this sort of opportunity to maybe get in early, and that was quite exciting. And it sort of was this idea that maybe it didn't matter that you didn't have all the money and all the experience to be able to do this. Like it seemed like maybe the kind of thing you could in fact do, you know, just scaling up a homebrew kind of level of skills. And so that's what we did.
Why is it a little bit less or a lot less capital intensive to ferment apples than to ferment beer?
Well, one of the main reasons is that the cider is much more similar in how it's made to wine. And so realistically, you know, at a simplest scale, all you need to do is start with the juice. And even if you do absolutely nothing else, it will ferment to cider with, you know, pretty good reliability. Whereas with beer, you know, you need to heat the wort, and there's just a lot more gear that you
typically, I see.
But my impression is that you kind of needed to set up a brewery. Whereas wine, I mean, or cider, really, like you could, in fact, we did get out of the gate with just a couple of used IBC tanks that we got, you know, on Craigslist for $100 that would hold that volume of cider. You know, there is, and then of course all the other pieces came afterwards, like for bottling and capping and boxing and labels and all that stuff. You do all need that level of equipment, but you know, just to get out of the gate to actually just make the physical product, the capital that you need is actually really small.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot. So like my background is a mixed veggie production, and there's so many people like you and I that came to these disciplines or these vocations of or these subsets of farming that chose them partly because they're not very capital intensive. It's very similar with mixed veggies. A lot of non-farmers who are young who want to get into farming, it's a great way in. So there's a parallel there.
Totally.
Anyway, yeah.
You could spend $100,000 on a tractor for your level, or you could spend probably $2,000 on a tractor and get more or less the equivalent utility.
You can get going. Absolutely. So, okay, take us back though to just like chronologically. So can you bring in, like you had partners to start out?
Having partners, Luke Sisa and Robin Cairns, was sort of instrumental in getting going. In fact, I can say with 100% certainty, this wouldn't even have started without having two other people involved. Those partners have now since kind of taken a more observant role, like they're sort of less actively involved in the day-to-day activities. But certainly for the first 5 years, and then even still, to some degree, there was like, it was a total divide and conquer, and wouldn't have been possible with just one, I don't think.
And it sounds, am I correct that from the outset, you and your partners decided you wanted to own the trees that you were going to use? Like you bought an orchard at the jump, didn't you?
That's right. Well, pretty close. Yeah. So we essentially formed the company, and then, you know, there's different types of licensing, and you could have a winery or cidery and not actually own any land or own any apples. You can do that. It's called a commercial license. But the government taxes it much less favorably. And so there's like a way, if you can figure out the land piece and actually grow at least some percentage of your own fruit, then you get what's called a land-based license. And that is a much more, it makes the business a lot easier because there's a lot less taxes involved on the government level. So we sort of realized that would be the most opportune way to do this business. So at that time, my wife and I started looking at properties in Summerland that would meet the kind of minimum requirement to have a land-based winery license, which at the time was only 2.5 acres. And there wasn't that much available. And then this particular property came up, and it's 10 acres, which was like way outside of our sort of plan and our budget, but we managed to scrape it together to get the property. And so once we had the property, then it became just a series of steps to like get the apples planted and get the cidery or get, you know, a structure built that would be licensed to ferment alcohol. And the property didn't have had no apples on it, so we had to plant from scratch, which was maybe not the best decision. But
I imagine that at some point originally you figured you'd be aiming to buy an operational apple orchard.
100%. And that was the original idea, but we chose not to do that for a few reasons and settled on this other property that essentially one of the main reasons is it had already a space that we could use. It was a barn that we could use, a Quonset hut that we were able to repurpose for making it into the cidery. And then at the time, we get more into this later, but the impression was that the best apple cider, and it's to some degree still is correct, is made from these cider specific apple varieties. These are apples that are grown only for making cider, many of which have, you know, long histories in England and France and in some degree even in North America, you know, basically being grown only for fermented cider. And the impression, at least at the time, sort of 10 years ago when we were sort of doing this, was that cider made from just your standard run-of-the-mill Macintosh or your Spartans or Ambrosia was sort of lesser quality and it was not going to be as good. So, you know, at the time I was like, well, we need to plant apples. So we need to find a place. Ideally, we find a place with either we have to rip out the old trees and plant new ones or graft them. Or in this case, we started from scratch. So we planted, and so we have cider, like the only apples that are growing on this property are cider specific apple varieties that are, sort of like these heirloom apples, many of which were sort of grown for multi-purpose years ago, cooking, baking, juice, applesauce, as well as cider, but all of which are sort of known to be sort of add good qualities to fermented apple cider.
So that was, I mean, that ended up being a silver lining of buying bare land then, is that it gave you in some ways probably a little bit cheaper to intentionally grow those cider varieties versus having to rip out and replant or graft or whatever.
100%. Yeah. No, I agree. However, I've now come more to the line of thinking that you make actually quite good cider with almost any apple variety. It's a lot to do with the technique you use and sort of how you, what you want to do with the cider. So certainly, but I think to some degree, like the original intention, which is like you're making a straight pure apple cider, you know, no other additives, juices or other fruits or anything, you know, straight up, like then it is still true that really the best ones do come from these ciders that are using cider specific apples. So
what I'm kind of hearing is that you discovered, you know, it would make sense as someone relatively new that you really embrace this idea that you had, if you really wanted to make real cider, you had to have these traditional cider varieties. But then maybe it sounds like you learned or decided that as you got more experience that this was more something just based in tradition and maybe even, you know, purist snobbery or something.
100%. Yeah. Yep. A lot of dogma.
Okay. And yet you did just tack on to the end there that you do think there's something to be said for these old varieties. So square the circle, like where do you currently sit?
Yeah, good question. Very, very good point. So here's how I kind of look at it is that cider as a category for consumers is still relatively new. Even 10 years in, you know, it's still, people are still like, wow, craft cider, huh? Never thought of that before. So, and when I think it's very similar to when you're introduced to a new product, whether that's like whiskey or coffee or wine, and sort of often like your initial taste preferences evolve with time. And so what happens is, or at least we sort of find, like a lot of people come to cider for the first time and they think they like, or they do in fact, you know, prefer maybe a sweeter cider, one that has sort of very direct apple aromas, or they also want something with different flavors in it. So it's apple with ginger, apple with raspberry, apple with nectarine, you name it, you know, like any other number of flavors. And in those circumstances, the apple varieties, like the traditional English and French apple varieties, which add all this extra character and depth and mouthfeel and astringency, and often sometimes some like funkier kind of barnyardy kind of flavors, which are at a connoisseur level, like sought after and appreciated, but at sort of like the general public's level, most often either not even noticed or sometimes even unappreciated. So ironically, what would be our kind of contenders for like award-winning ciders at like a cider snob level are ones that like many of our consumers don't like and are not for them. They're either too astringent or too acidic or have kind of characteristics which to them are almost considered negative, whereas at a high level cider connoisseur, those are ones that are sought after. So there's kind of this weird thing. It's like, who do you make cider for? And so, like, as a business, we kind of try to do a bit of both, where we have ciders that are, I don't call it mass market appeal, but that they're say more approachable to the first time cider drinker. And then we also have a series of ciders that are like, okay, well, if you already like cider, here's sort of level two. And so we have a whole series of ciders which are made exclusively with sort of French and English cider apple varieties and barrel aged and bottle conditioned, et cetera. And those are ones that, you can only really make if you have these cider specific apples. But to be honest, that's like actually become a fairly small part of our business. So it's cool to have it, but it's really not necessary. And I feel like I'm maybe denigrating a bit of our business, but it's important, I think, to make good quality cider regardless of the apples. But the fact is, you can still make a really good cider using, standard apple varieties that you see, already growing on orchards.
But I think also, like, isn't this just part of the fun of being involved in an emergent drink category, right? Like, what I mean is, you can kind of, there's a parallel with beer, right? Like, the collective palate changes over time. I came into adulthood right with the reemergence of craft beer, and there's been a total I've witnessed the trends, and there was the period when everything just seemed so crammed full of hops because that was the idea of good beer, and maybe that was a push and pull that was partly zealousness of the craft brewers at the time, but also trying to respond to what the collective palate wanted, right. And I think I would argue over time we've seen a huge expansion and diversification of that palette, and also a refinement. And so it's kind of interesting to hear you talk about cider in a similar way at a much earlier period in the evolution of the sector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, and that's, in fact, a good reason why I think it is a long-term good strategic option to have access to these, cider apple varieties, which are really hard to find on the open market. Like, essentially, if you don't grow them, they're almost impossible to buy. And, so as consumer taste preferences evolve and change, those will give us the opportunity to kind of offer those sort of higher end, more interesting, nuanced ciders that if you're only ever making your cider out of, straight ambrosia, it's not really possible to achieve it that way. But, exactly. Like I say, this is both a lifestyle and a business for me. And so we make ciders that I want to make ciders that I also want to drink and enjoy. And I also get a lot of satisfaction from growing these heirloom apple varieties, which, it's almost the only way to ever taste these apples. You can read about them in a catalog or a book, but unless you actually grow one, they're not available. Like, no one grows these things. So it's kind of neat I found it really fascinating and a really fulfilling and interesting part of the business to have these sort of heirloom apple varieties. And we have probably 45 different varieties now, some of them in greater proportion than others, but, ones that, haven't really been seen in the valley for 100 years sometimes, or if ever, so some of these are ones that are almost not grown at all, and certainly never commercially, but not even at the hobbyist level. So that's kind of fun. And that allows me to that's kind of why we do this. It's not just about making money, or making basic cider that has mass appeal. It's about, making ciders that both can find a market, but also ones that we are proud of and allow us to try out some new things and some new ideas and to showcase what we can do with some of these more interesting and unusual apple varieties.
I want to pause right now and just give us a snapshot of the business super briefly as it currently is, in the sense of, is your scale of apple production still at that 10 acre property level? Are you bringing in other apples?
The orchard itself here is only just starting to hit some stride. In many cases is actually, still probably 5 years away from really producing at full speed. And so in the meantime, I also leased another orchard. In fact, that was sort of instrumental in learning how to do the farming side, is sort of like, as I said, came in with this. We bought the property, planted trees. Those trees were little sticks, they weren't gonna make any apples. So if we wanted to make cider, we need to get the apples from somewhere. We had a family friend, fellow here in Summerland, that used to fix my old beat up Volkswagen Jetta when I was in high school. He's was a German legend named Klaus Haverkamp, who had an orchard that he was, he's basically turning 80 and was ready to kind of somewhat wind down his involvement in the day-to-day aspects of the orchard. A lot of old varieties planted in the 60s and 70s. And so it was an opportunity for me to kind of come in and learn sort of the ropes under his sort of tutelage. And then in exchange for that, you know, that lease, we got to take the apples, and those are what we made the cider from for the first few years.
Okay. And then can you give me on the sales and marketing end, like what's happening? Is it what percentage are you moving through your tasting room on your site, and where else, if anywhere else, is your cider going?
Yeah, we're actually, compared to many cideries, we're actually more of a wholesale business model, meaning that we actually do more of our sales off-site through bars and restaurants. So either liquor stores, bars and restaurants, then we actually do on-site retail. And that's partially just because when we first started the business, the other two partners who I mentioned, Robbie and Luke, both lived still in Vancouver. And Vancouver, at least, well, still to the main degree, is sort of the main market for our products. So that actually worked fine. And so I would say, you know, if you wanted a percentage, I'd say probably 70% of our business is wholesale, and the other 30% is on-site retail and farmers markets here in the Okanagan. So we do have a space to taste, and people can come to the property. We do have, you've been here, Jordan. It's pretty rustic. You know, it's a concrete pad in front of a steel Quonset. You know, a couple picnic tables and a wood bar. Basically,
that doesn't capture the romanticism of visiting.
Oh,
Dominion.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. But you know, like it's pretty rustic. It's almost purposely so. You know, we keep it very simple. But you can come over and, you know, you open the hatch of the cidery, and you can see directly everything that's happening. There's nothing's hidden. It's all right in front. It's both the warts and all. And to some degree, I think people really like that part about it, that it is, you know, it's the least pretentious kind of thing you can expect. There are no marble pillars at Dominion Cider. There's only rusty equipment.
So here's a self-contained question. Think about one of the, you know, hundreds of apple growers in our valley growing apples to eat as apples. What problems or challenges of that market and style of production do you avoid by making cider, and what new problems do you take on?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, what I'm doing is so, even though we're both growing apple trees, like the business model is so different than, say, my neighbor, who is a commercial grower who sells to the packing house. And the main reason is that we are Dominion is the end user of all the apples that can be produced. So there's no need to market the apples. Like, the raw materials are essentially pre-sold before they're even grown. Whereas with a commercial grower, you know, you're basically putting your apples into a pool where you are, you know, essentially a price taker, and it becomes essentially just a commodity. And I think, you know, as we've seen over the last years, like that model is really difficult because you don't control the price. You don't, you have very little control over the return that you're going to get. I guess aside from just like the quality of apples that you put in, but, you know, so the other thing about making apple cider is like every single apple, its ultimate role is to make juice. So there's a whole host of advantages to that for me, in that, you know, we, for a lot of apple, like a lot for commercial growers, cosmetics are critical. Like if the apple has, it's not red enough or not yellow enough, or it's got a mark from where it, you know, rubbed against a branch, or it's too small, or it's too big, it's misshapen in some way, like any of those are reasons to cull the apple. And in fact, if you throw too many of those in your bin, then you actually get docked money, and you can even find yourself in a situation where you're charged for apples that you've, you know, grown and submitted to a packing house that were undergrade. In our case, like every single apple on the tree gets juiced, so there's zero waste, and I don't care at all what they look like. So
but does that also mean? Can you allow, if you chose,
sure,
like can there be pest damage out the yin yang, and you don't like, can you just let that happen?
Healthy trees make good apples, which make the best cider. But that is, some level of pest damage is not as important. It's not a game changer. So, you know, we want the trees to stay healthy. So we manage the orchard in a way that, or I manage the orchard in a way, hopefully, that keeps the trees in good health. But, you know, for example, if you had some coddling moth damage, you know, that's not a game changer unless it starts to cause the apples to rot, which is a problem. But, you know, lots of things, you know, think of like, even like apple scab, for example, which is a, you know, a big problem for some orchards. That's primarily a cosmetic issue and, you know, has little to no impact on juice flavor. So, you know, that's an example where there's like a whole host of management and sprays and stuff that are essentially able to be avoided, you know, short of, you don't want these problems, but, you know, if you do have them, it's not a devastation to the orchard. And so that's been a huge advantage, especially as someone, you know, without a lot of experience or with no experience coming in, you know, gives you some leeway to make some mistakes and not have it be a, you know, catastrophe.
So that's a bit, your last comments are a bit of a segue into my next kind of line of questioning. I want to talk about what sustainability and stewardship mean to you as far as on the production side, on the farming side. You're an organic farmer, right?
We're not currently certified, although I am actually eligible for certification now. This is going into the fourth season of organic management. So the first, this is 8 years. So the first 4 years, it was, I managed it conventionally. And I think, you know, I think we talked about this at the time was that, you know, my mentors, like everyone that I knew when I came into this with no understanding of how to run an orchard, everyone that I knew farmed conventionally. And that means, you know, weed spraying and pest spraying, pesticide spraying. And then, and including the orchard that I managed, or that I leased, from Klaus Haverkamp, that was, you know, how he'd done things for 40 years. And that was how they were going to continue to be done. And there was not really any option for debating that. And it was only about after the first three or four years, I suppose, of farming that way, you know, I kind of came to the realization that maybe that's actually, I mean, that's not really in line with how I want to manage the property. And it also, you know, I became pretty clear, like these are, you know, a lot of these techniques are primarily for, you know, reasons which are cosmetic or like, you know, would allow you to produce the most beautiful looking apples because that's the only way you're going to be able to make any money as a commercial grower. And I was not a commercial grower and every apple was already essentially pre-sold, as I said. So therefore there was like this opportunity, it seemed to me like a really good opportunity to, you know, de-risk the transition to organic, because, you know, I'm already have a guaranteed market for them. So that was the genesis of the transition. And yeah, so we've basically haven't sprayed anything other than nutrients and no weed sprayings for the last 4 years.
So like I really, part of my goal with these conversations is to kind of bridge what I see as a bit of a gap or to address a tension between organic farmers and conventional farmers or people just on different parts of the spectrum in terms of their approach and ideas about sustainability and stewardship. I'm wondering, you did start out more or less conventional. Your mentors, it sounds like, were conventional. Everyone around you, most were conventional. What is there anything, are there any tools or techniques that you miss that you like really wish you still had access to?
Not really. I mean, I think the biggest challenge or not one of the, one of the main challenges that I've come across is just understory management of the trees. Now, when you're in a weed spray environment or, you know, in a weed spray situation, you can keep that understory in check quite easily. And without that, then your options are much more labor intensive or equipment intensive. So we have a swing arm mower that'll sort of swing in between the trees to mow underneath the understory. That works fairly well. And, you know, we try to touch up with weed whacking, which is time consuming and difficult. So, and often and results in hitting the trees, et cetera. So there's some difficulty that way that, you know, I wish that was a little bit easier. Like if there was an, you know, organic weed spray that was effective and cost effective that could like keep the understory a little bit lower, that would be pretty helpful for us. But I'd say other than that, I don't miss, there's kind of nothing that dramatically that I miss.
And thinking back to your mentor, you know, he would have right from the outset been sharing opinions about his, you know, he oh, sounds yeah. like he's a big proponent of conventional techniques. You know, are you at a point now, is there anything you think, even if you haven't tried, you think you might be, now that you've gone through the organic transition process, that you might be able to convince him of, like in terms of like just changing his mind about any criticisms he might have had or reservations about organic practices?
You know, I think in this particular case, like with my previous, the owner of the orchard that I was leasing, you know, there is a way of, like when you've done something the same way for so long, it's quite difficult to sort of conceptualize that there might be any other way of doing it. And well, I'd say close was, you know, like that orchard was, I would say minimal spray, you know, probably bordering on IPM kind of level of management. You know, there still was, I don't think I was going to convince him of an organic approach necessarily. And my answer, my other mentors sort of similarly, like I, you know, one of my other good friends, we have lunch all the time, but his sort of motto is better living through chemistry. So it's really not a spray that he hasn't tried. You know, but I think probably what would be one of the most compelling arguments has less to do with, you know, any kind of personal conviction or perception of what's better, but really is just around cost. And, you know, and I think that's like an argument that is, I think, getting easier and easier to make. Like each of these sprays, you know, I'll pick one that was for an aphid spray I used to buy, and it was like $600 for a 1 liter bottle. And you need like four or five of them, you know, over the year. And you're like, that's only one example, and there are many more, and each of these things only gets more and more expensive with time. Most of them are all fossil fuel based. You know, you can spend a lot of money on sprays. And so the flip side to that is like, you could manage it organically and perhaps, you know, you would suffer, you would have maybe potentially you'd have a reduction in yield. Maybe, you know, I think that's, you know, pretty common, but it's like, you know, so your production and yield. So is that reduction in yield, but can you say you've saved all this time, money, effort, you know, is that, you know, at some point there's a break even there where a slight reduction in yield actually gets you ahead still because you haven't had to do all these other sprays and such. So yeah, that was, that's, I think, you know, I think a reason that was maybe harder to make when things were dirt cheap, but like as these sprays and as the cost of conventional farm management continue to rise, then like the comparative effort required for organic management starts to look, you know, potentially better in that light. At least that's my impression for apples. I don't know what it would be like for veggies.
So are there any major do-overs you wish you had, or is there something you were like, a set of assumptions you made that were terribly wrong, or anything you were super unprepared for in terms of what you're expecting as you got going, or at some point as you've grown the business?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure there's dozens. But I like one small example I can think of off the top of my head is about, the third year after planting, I decided, I was like, oh, you know what? I want more varieties. And cause I had only had seven varieties at the time. That was just a function of when you purchase trees, you have to get a minimum purchase order. And, you know, so you had like, I only had seven varieties and I wanted more. So I grafted over again with very little experience or knowledge. My neighbor came by and showed me how I grafted over almost a third of the orchard, or more, half the orchard probably in the end, to other cider apple varieties. So I went through the catalog at Summerland Varieties, which is at the research station in town, who have a sort of library catalog of heirloom apple varieties that you can buy the budwood from so you can grow the trees from. So I did. And so I have now dozens of varieties. What I didn't realize at the time, and I didn't really think that through very well, was like that the desire for more variety also comes with some risks in that like those varieties may or may not be well suited to your site. And in addition to that, by the just the very act of grafting is like a pretty dramatic intervention, to say the least, and that doesn't always work. I'd say that was my, you know, couple years in, pretty excited, wanted more variety, wanted to have like, you know, more must, if a few is good, more must be better kind of approach. And in fact, like what I've now learned is like what's most important is like healthy trees that like growing where in your soil condition. Those are what you want. Because they'll require less management, they'll be less susceptible to disease, they'll be able to handle drought. Those are kind of what you want, and I should have been sort of selecting for those characteristics rather than just like what might make neat cider, if you know what I mean.
I do, yeah. I'm really curious to know about like in your subsector, in cidery, and even cidery in the Okanagan, if you like. What are the burning issues or concerns? Like what do you talk about with your colleagues? What keeps people up at night? That sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, it's actually quite interesting. This past year, or actually just even a few weeks ago, I had an opportunity to meet with a bunch of other cidery owners. There was quite a large conference in Penticton, sort of wine focused conference, but that, you know, cider, tails onto, and a lot of the overall sentiment was quite negative. There's sort of been lots of, well, especially in wine, there's been lots of negative impacts to the wine industry in the Okanagan for various reasons, you know, weather related, of course, but also fire related and road closures, et cetera, which have caused sort of some serious challenges in the wine industry. And cider has been, I think, a bit more resilient than that. Certainly like our inputs, like our apples, like our apple trees are a lot more resilient than vines for cold temperatures, but the, you know, the overall industry sentiment has certainly darkened in the last few years. And in addition to that, it's sort of like this declining consumer preferences for sort of alcohol products of all types. And, you know, I think as a society, that's probably not a problem, you know, but as a producer that makes alcohol, that is actually sort of a, you know, a critical challenge. So, you know,
you gotta get them young. You gotta get your cider in the schools, man, in the lunch programs.
You know, I think just like, you know, like there's a role for responsible consumption. And I think cider actually fits nicely in that because it's a lower ABV product, more like beer, but can be consumed like wine. So you can have it with dinner, et cetera. So that kind of thing is interesting. But so we're exploring, you know, that is something that a lot of the other cideries are kind of grappling with, the water wineries, et cetera. And just how do you manage sort of in a situation where it's like, if every year it's smoky in the Okanagan and that reduces the tourism numbers, how do you survive? And as I mentioned, you know, our business is a little bit less resilient on on-site retail, but I would say that is a bit of an exception. Most wineries and cideries do most of their business right on site. And that's because it's the most profitable. There's no margin. There's the highest margin. There's no distribution costs, et cetera. And in another, you know, if we were to reorganize the business from scratch, we might have chosen that business model or more directly the sort of on-site retail model. You know, so it really underlines to me like the necessity to be flexible and to be able to sell your products in different markets and figure out what the consumer preferences are and stay ahead of those. And if those are changing to lower ABV, then that's maybe something that cider can work with, whether that or non-alcoholic, for example.
Are there any misconceptions you could identify about food production, farming, or specifically your work making cider?
You know, I think certainly from the cider making perspective, cider as a product is often consumed similar to beer, and it's assumed that the price point should be similar to beer because it's, you know, you have a pint of cider, you got a pint of, you know, Pilsner at your pub. Even though that like the production of those two products is very different, and in fact, cider is produced and has a lot of similar costs, very similar to winemaking, as opposed to beer where you can, you know, so want cider, you know, it's an agricultural product made once per year. Like the apples are only ripe once a year. You can make only as much apple cider as you have apples to do it with. And, you know, whereas beer, you can make it, you can brew year round, you buy the barley, you can store it, malt. And that I think has actually been something to really kind of, it has been a challenging thing for the craft cider industry, in general, is to sort of, how do you elevate or how do you, you know, educate the consumer to like want to pay a little bit more for craft cider, especially stuff that's like made with 100% local juice, you know, made by hand, grown by apples that are, you know, organically managed in some cases. How do you convince consumers of that product is sort of worth similar to a bottle of wine? And that's been an ongoing challenge and something that I think the industry is still kind of trying to figure out. But I do think that, you know, when we talk about it, when we talk about cider and, you know, when we're at a farmer's market and I'm doing a pouring for someone and, you know, the actual conception of how cider is made is actually quite low in many cases. And it's not really known that it's, you know, it's like an apple wine for all intents and purposes.
Mike, can you think of an investment you made for your business that was scary to make, but that you are so glad you made?
Sure. Yeah, I can think of one. It's just quite recently. So we, you know, talk about market trends and sort of being in tune to those. And, you know, we have, you know, since inception made bottled cider, like in a glass bottle with a cap on it. And that's something that we have been able to do on site and, you know, can control production of. But we sort of found over the last 5 years that like bottle sales were slowly declining. And so we did some trials with canned cider. And we were one of the earlier cideries to start canning cider. which was great. And that was a product that actually, you know, was growing and has continued to grow. And so that's become a key part of our business. But that infrastructure, the stuff to put it in cans was like a tool that we didn't have. So we had to hire that. So there's companies that will come on a flatbed trailer with a giant canning line, and you basically just plug your tank into that and out shoot cans out the other end. And that's great. And it's very fast, very efficient. And the one downside is that it's also very expensive. And so what we sort of realized is that in order to protect margin, we decided to invest in a canning line. So we bought a small secondhand one off a brewery in Vancouver this spring, just one can at a time. So it's like, you know, it's about 4 times slower than what we were doing when we were hiring it out, but we have reduced our cost by half by doing it ourselves. And it gives us a lot more control. So we can do a smaller batch. We can do sort of a more niche product. Whereas before, you'd kind of want to make, if you're going to bring this machine out, you know, hire this out, then you need to like maximize its use, since you'd be doing only the largest runs you could. So that's been kind of an investment in the business that has actually really been kind of a neat way to move the company forward. And it actually also kind of sparked this kind of realization that, you know, the more of the processes that we can do in-house in an environment where, you know, sales are hard and there's lots of competition and maybe the consumer preferences are changing, then it is really critical that we, every dollar counts. And so that we try to keep all those in-house if we can. So that's, so the next in line is like a juicing rig, which allows to do all the juicing on site as well, which we hope to get this year. Yeah. So ask me again next time and we'll let you know how that one goes.
Awesome. It's a deal. All right. Last question then. You're a farmer, and I always try and ask a version of this question, which is just like, talk about a moment that comes up in your farming where it's just whatever, peaceful, zen, or just justifies all the effort.
Yeah. You know what? Actually, I had one this year when it was pruning, which is not usually my favorite activity. You know, it's usually in January. It's cold. You got your boots on, snow deep, snow's knee deep. But, and I had this revelation where I'd be pruning, and then I had my phone on, you know, I'd listen to music on my phone, and I'd get a text message or I'd hear a chime for a notification, and I had to stop what I was doing, take my gloves off, pull up my phone, check it. And sure enough, it'd be like my mom with a happy face sign. Great. Thanks. Put your boots back on. You know, now I've lost 5 minutes and lost my flow. So what I've actually started doing this year the rest of that pruning season is I fired up my old iPod that I had from 2008 that still worked, and loaded up that music and podcasts, and I stopped using my phone while I was actually in the field. And that provided me this like the most mental peace that I've had in years. And I've actually carried that forward through other aspects of the day now, where I'll just like leave the phone at home. I'll check, you know, come in for lunch, check the messages, and pretty much deal with anything that's, you know, and if it's a burning emergency, you know, like I'm at the orchard, you can always get a hold of me somehow, call, you know, shout out the window and I can probably hear you. So that bit of zen, that sort of like just getting into a flow state where you're just kind of doing a process where, whether it's pruning or mowing or some sort of like just hands-on manual labor job, that without any distraction to that like has actually probably freed up more mental space and given me more of a sense of peace than almost anything else I've done.
Mike Harris, thanks so much for joining me to share your insights and tell us about your operation. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks a lot, Jordan. And I'm happy to chat with anybody else too. If anyone has any questions or wants to get in touch, you can always reach out. And I really appreciate this opportunity.
Hello? Are you still listening? Did you make it here? Thanks for doing so. I hope you like that. Fun fact, everyone, I developed a decently bad bloody nose when I was recording this interview with Mike, but I'm a professional, so I kept the interview going and Mike was never the wiser. Or maybe he did hear my sniffles and decided it would be impolite to inquire about my cocaine habit. Anyway, I totally forgot about the bloody nose until I edited this, and then I started hearing a bunch of sniffing halfway through and I thought, what am I doing there? And then I remembered, and I muted all the sniffing so you wouldn't hear it during the episode. But for inquiring minds, I've left a little sample of what that sounded like right at the end. What else? If you have suggestions for future guests of the show, I'm all ears. Podcast at farminginbc.ca.
That's also where you can stream episodes of the podcast. Finally, if you're a farmer in British Columbia, remember, we have a lot more in common than all our differences would suggest. Okay, talk to you next time.
But I think also, like, isn't this just part of the fun of being involved in an emergent drink category, right? Like, what I mean is, you can kind of, there's a parallel with beer, right? Like, the collective palate changes over time. I came into adulthood right with the, like, reemergence of craft beer. And there's been a total, like, I've, like, witnessed the trends, and there was the period when everything just seemed so crammed full of hops because that was the idea of, like, good beer. And maybe that was a push and pull. That was partly...